I feel I am among friends. And just one moment ago, literally, I picked up this book and read a wonderful little paragraph by C.S. Lewis from The Four Loves on friendship, and it exemplifies what I hope will exist here tonight among us. Let me read it to you. This is the kind of, quote, lecture that I hope to give. These are the golden sessions, when our slippers are on, our feet spread out toward the blaze, and our drinks at our elbows, when the whole world, and something beyond the world, opens itself to our minds as we talk, and no one has any claim on or any responsibility for another, but all are free men and equals, as if we had first met an hour ago, while at the same time an affection, mellowed by the years, unfolds us. Life, natural life, has no better gift to give than friendship. Who could have deserved it? Most of you are Presbyterians, or at least evangelical Protestants. I grew up in the Dutch Reformed Church. I became a Roman Catholic, but I never left. I am an evangelical Catholic. You are friends. I get invited to such people more often than to anyone else. And we all feel totally at home in C.S. Lewis. Tim had the good sense to invite me here to talk about C.S. Lewis, not about myself or my own books or something abstract. And he said, let's give four talks, and I picked four books, starting with Mere Christianity, which is the heart of Lewis's faith, then The Problem of Pain, which is the best book I know of about the best argument against Christianity, The Problem of Suffering, and then that same problem in two other books, both narratives, one of them fiction, Till We Have Faces, and another fact in Lewis's own life, A Grief Observed. The movie about Lewis's life, Shadowlands, is based quite a bit on A Grief Observed. I hope we've all seen that movie. If not, go out and see it. I'd like to take a poll just to see, for my own curiosity, how mixed the audience is. How many of you have read at least six books by C.S. Lewis? Okay. How many of you have never read any books by C.S. Lewis? Okay. How many of you have read Mere Christianity? Okay. I like the challenge of speaking to mixed audiences. It opens up both of us. My teaching method that I find works best is to be a dwarf standing on the shoulders of a giant. This is not my lecture, it's C.S. Lewis's lecture, but you can't have Lewis here with you, alas, except through the book. So I will be his servant. I will climb up on his shoulders, and together we will talk to you. It's the closest thing to having the master here present. So I'm going to sell a book. Many of you have read the book already. Let me ask you another question. Of those of you who have read Mere Christianity, how many of you have read it only once? Shame on you. Well, I'll motivate those of you who haven't read it once to read it once, and those who have read it once to read it twice, and those who have read it twice to read it three times. A little personal note. I have to confess that when at Calvin College I first read this book, it was because my roommate praised it. He said, this is the book that saved my faith. He was losing his faith, and he read this book and Bertrand Russell's book, Why I Am Not a Christian, and he thought Russell's book was so absurd and Lewis's book was so clear that he said, this is it. Well, my roommate was a very bright fellow, so I had read a couple of other books by Lewis, including The Problem of Pain. So I read this one, and God forgive me, I was disappointed. It was too simple. I said to myself, oh, I know all this stuff already. This book has converted great people, like, or been the instrument in converting great people, only God converts, like Chuck Colson. And two other fairly famous people whose names I have forgotten, so I guess they're not that famous. But every single one of the three said that the most important chapter in this book was the one on pride. And what I've just confessed to you, namely that the first time I read the book, I thought it was too simple, means that I should have read that chapter more carefully. Because this is a masterpiece. It's a masterpiece because it's incredibly simple. When people ask me, who don't know much about Christianity, what book should I read about it? I say, after the Gospels, Mere Christianity. I know of no other book ever written that, at least to people of our time, more accomplishes what we're all supposed to be accomplishing in this act of evangelism or spreading the truth than this one. It's all here. It's here simply, honestly, clearly, and intelligently. It wasn't a book. It was a series of broadcast talks during World War II over the BBC. So it had to be addressed to everybody. It wasn't to academics. It wasn't to any particular group. The secret of its power, I think, is partly its simplicity. But deeper than that, I think, its secret is its absolute and total honesty. Every once in a while, you find a writer, whether you agree with him or not, whether you understand him or not, who's totally trustable, who just has no baloney, no gas, no can't, nothing fake. That's rare. To my mind, St. Augustine is that kind of a writer, just incapable of not facing a question, however difficult it is, and dealing with it until he sees his way through to it. But even deeper than that, I think the secret of this book is that even though it deals with all of Christianity, even though it covers the waterfront, there are chapters on theology, on morality, on the supernatural, on the natural, yet it is, from cover to cover, Christocentric. This is not so much about Christianity as it is about Christ. If you were to pick out how many paragraphs are about Christ himself, it wouldn't seem that there are too many. But then, if you were to do the same thing with the Bible, outside of the Gospels, if you were to make a number, what percentage of verses explicitly talks about Christ? The percentage would be maybe, I don't know, 20% in the New Testament, 10% in the Old Testament, explicitly messianic passages, and yet the whole Bible is Christ. It's his portrait. Every single word is a cell in his face. And if you see that center, then you understand the book. And amazingly, we don't often see that center. We know it, but we forget it. This is the simplest, most basic foundation of everything. But it's hidden. Not deliberately hidden, but it's like the earth. You don't notice the earth, but you're always standing on it. Or the air. You don't notice the air. You're always breathing it. The title is almost more important than the book. Mere is not an insulting title. It means pure, simple, not mixed. He explains the title this way. Ever since I became a Christian, this is the preface, I have thought that the best, perhaps the only, service that I could do for my unbelieving neighbors was to explain and defend the belief that has been common to nearly all Christians at all times. Now, technically, that's known as the Vincentian canon. There was a saint named Vincent of Lerins who addressed the question, which dogmas are required for all Christians to believe and which issues are matters of legitimate speculation? And his criterion was almost word for word this, that which has been believed by nearly all Christians at all times and places. I got the impression, Lewis says, that far more and more talented authors were already engaged in such controversial matters than in the defense of what Baxter called mere Christianity. That part of the battle line where I thought I could serve best was also the part that seemed to be the thinnest, but the most important, the basics. And so to it I naturally went. Now, if you know Lewis, you know that the man is a genius, and he's written 50 or 60 books on almost every subject under the sun, And he is perfectly capable of branching out into dozens of different areas and turning everything that he writes into gold. So this is almost false modesty. That's the only thing I could do. And yet that Lewis should write such a most simple and most basic book is a great task, a difficult task. It's harder to write a simple book than a complex book. One of our presidents, I forget which, was one, Woodrow Wilson, was once asked how long it took him to make up a one-hour speech. And he said, oh, 2 or 3 hours. And then he was asked, well, how long would it take you to make up a 5-minute speech? And he said, oh, a week or two. The simple stuff is the hardest. The youngest apostle, John, who lived the longest, in his old age, was criticized by some of his disciples for being too simple. And that simplicity you can see in his epistle, his first and longest epistle in the New Testament, because he's only talking about love. And they said, all you talk about is love. And he said, that's right. That's all there is to talk about in one way or another. When you get old, you see things simply. When you're at the height of your powers, I suppose that's the time to branch out. But when you're very young and when you're very old, you come to a point. Now, Lewis was middle-aged, neither young nor old when he wrote this, but he was humble enough to come to a point. The point that is mere Christianity, and here's a crucial thing, the point is not something abstract. It's not that the book looked at the thousands of different things Christians have believed and asked the question, well, how many of them do all the different kinds of Christians believe? And how many of them are disputed between different churches and denominations? So I'll leave the disputed points and give you a lowest common denominator. That is not what mere Christianity means, and he explicitly says so. He says, so far as I can judge from reviews and from the numerous letters written to me, the book, however faulty in other respects, did at least succeed in presenting a common or central or mere Christianity. In that way, it may be possibly of some help in silencing the view that if we omit the disputed points, we shall have left only a vague and bloodless HCF. Now, HCF is British for highest common factor, which is what they call, what we call, lowest common denominator. Their highest were lowest, I guess. The HCF turns out to be something not only positive, but pungent, divided from all non-Christian beliefs by a chasm to which the worst divisions inside Christendom are not really comparable at all. If I have not directly helped the cause of reunion, I have perhaps made it clear why we ought to be reunited. Certainly, I have met with little of the fabled odium theologicum, theological stink, literally, from convinced members of communions different from my own. Hostility has come much more from the borderline people within my own church, the Church of England, or outside of it, men not obedient to any communion. This I find curiously consoling. It is at her center, where her truest children dwell, that each communion is really closest to every other. And this suggests that at the center of each there is something, or rather someone, who, against all divergences of belief, all differences of temperament, all memories of mutual persecution, speaks with the same voice. I know of no published work that has done more for ecumenism, for honest communication and understanding and even reunion than this. I don't know any good, solid, Orthodox believing Catholic or Protestant who doesn't love this book. And not because it avoids controversial issues. Flannery O'Connor, great Catholic short story writer, said back in the early 50s, talking to Southern Baptist ministers in the South, where there's about 1 or 2% Catholics, she said, you know, you Southern Baptists have more in common with the Pope than you do with some of these Northern Baptists. And they were shocked. She said, what are you talking about? She said, well, You know, the Pope believes that Mary was assumed into heaven, and you don't. But the Pope believes that Jesus rose from the dead, and you do, but they don't. Oh, yeah, maybe, you know, perspective. The book is not a solution to the problem of ecumenism or reunion or interfaith dialogue. Mere Christianity is not a solution, an alternative. He explicitly says at the end of the preface, "I hope no reader will suppose that mere Christianity is here put forward as an alternative to the creeds of the existing communions, as if anyone could adopt it in preference to Congregationalism or Greek Orthodoxy or anything else. It is more like a hall out of which doors open into several rooms. If I can bring anyone into that hall, I shall have done what I attempted. But it is in the rooms, not in the hall, that there are fires and chairs and meals. The hall is a place to wait in, a place from which to try the various doors, not a place to live in. Above all, you must be asking which door is the true one, not which pleases you best. The question should never be, do I like that kind of service, but are these doctrines true? Is there holiness here? Does my conscience move me towards this?" Now, that's very simple, but that's the essential advice to give in making any honest choice. There's only one reason why anybody should honestly believe anything, because it's true. If you think differently than that, let's get that settled before we do anything else in C.S. Lewis. William James said, great American psychologist and philosopher, he says, there's two very different types of minds, the tough-minded and the tender-minded. Everybody wants truth, and everybody wants happiness, but the tough-minded put truth first, and the tender-minded put happiness first. I think deep down we're all tough-minded, unless we're dishonest. How many of you believe in Santa Claus? Nobody? Remember how happy it made you to believe in Santa Claus on December 24th when you were about 3 or 4 years old? And remember how good you were, how well you behaved? Well, being happy and being good are terribly important. Well, why don't you keep believing in Santa Claus? If you could believe in Santa Claus, it would make you very happy and it would make you very good. Well, there's only one reason, you know, isn't true, not literally. Oh, so truth trumps everything. Yes, it does. Is truth more important than love? Well, it's not more important than love, but it is the root, and love is the fruit. You want true love. So unless you're tough-minded, you won't like this book. I've had students, intelligent students, otherwise intelligent students, who understand this book very well and hate it. I love that. Oh, it's getting to them. It's touching in the heart, not just the head. I had one who said, I put this book on my windowsill and I throw shoes at it every night. Good. The man Lewis regarded as his spiritual master, George MacDonald. I highly recommend, by the way, Lewis's anthology of George MacDonald. One of those excerpts is, hatred against God is far closer to God than indifference to him. There are four parts to this book. It's really three books written in different years. First one in 1943, next one in 1945, the last one in 1952, and then put together. But it fits together nicely. The first book is called Right and Wrong as a Clue to the Meaning of the Universe, and that's about ethics or morality. And the appeal is simply to human reason and experience. There's no appeal to faith or divine revelation. Book two is called What Christians Believe, and that's about God, or theology. And there, too, the appeal is simply to reason, not to faith or divine revelation. Then in the last two books, Lewis deals with the distinctly Christian beliefs about morality and theology, which do presuppose faith and divine revelation. The third book is called Christian Behavior, and the fourth book is called Beyond Personality, First Steps in the Doctrine of the Trinity. So the four books are about the good and the true, or ethics and theology, starting with reason, all that reason can do, and it can climb a little bit of the mountain. It can get you to the beach, though not in the water, and then the rest is jumping into the water. What I'm going to do is take the first part of the book, which is very logical and argumentative, and summarize the main steps in the argument very briefly. And then in the rest of the book, I'll just give you samples, like a smorgasbord, to give you a taste of some of the highlights to motivate you to read it again. He begins with data. Anybody who's honest begins with data. You can't argue with data. This happens. You can argue with interpretation. The secret of the scientific method, I think, the reason why we've been much better, much, much better at science for the last 400 years than we were for the previous 2,000, because people have always been curious about scientific questions, but how come the ancients and the medievals weren't very good at it? They didn't have the scientific method. And the most important step in the scientific method is have your theories totally dependent upon data. A theory works only insofar as it explains the data. The data control the theory. So Lewis, very scientifically, starts with data. And he starts with the observation of people quarreling. Everybody, no matter what they believe, argue. They argue about what's right and wrong, what's good and evil. Even if they're moral relativists in theory, nobody is a moral relativist in practice. Treat them as if morality were simply a set of preferences like chocolate ice cream or vanilla ice cream that we impose upon each other, and it simply won't work. I had a class of moral relativists once in ethics, so they were arguing that justice is just a word for power. The guys who make the laws get to define what's right and wrong, so their definition goes. But how did they get that power? Well, power. So it's only power. So I said to them, you know, you're right, you've convinced me. So from now on, we'll run this class by your philosophy, not mine. And since I've got the power, here's my rule. And the rule is that all the women flunk and all the men pass. Is that, that's terrible. That's so arbitrary. That's so unjust. That's so unfair. I said, yes, I agree with you, but what are you appealing to now? Not power. I've got the power. You say I'm wrong because that's unfair. Oh, so you really do believe in an objective moral law after all. They saw the point. As Lewis says, start treating somebody in an unjust way and they'll immediately appeal not to their own feelings. They won't say, I don't like what you're doing to me. They'll appeal to morality. They'll say, that's unfair. You're trampling my rights. So we all do believe that we ought to behave in just and charitable and good ways. And secondly, the other piece of data is that we all complain that we don't behave that way. Those are his two essential pieces of data. And at the end of the very first chapter, he summarizes the data in these words. And if you don't have this starting point firmly in mind, then everything else that follows is going to be weak. These, then, are the only two points I want to make. First, that human beings all over the world have this curious idea that they ought to behave in a certain way, and they can't really get rid of that. Second, they do not, in fact, behave in that way. They know the natural law, and they break it. These two facts are the foundation of all clear thinking about ourselves and the universe that we live in. That's a very solid foundation. I think the most effective apologist among the philosophers for our generation is Pascal. I wrote a whole book about him called Christianity for Modern Pagans. Pascal bases his whole structure also on data. Four pieces of data, equally unarguable. Number one, every single human being wants complete happiness. Number two, every single human being wants complete truth. That is, he wants to understand everything. Number three, no human being has ever been completely happy. Number four, no human being has ever understood all truth. Nobody can deny, who's honest, those four pieces of data. From those four pieces of data, you can deduce just about everything that reason can deduce about Christianity. In the next few chapters, Lewis refutes moral relativism and its many objections in as clear and simple a way as I've ever seen. And then he asks the question, all right, now that we've got this data. There is a real moral law and we don't obey it. What does that prove? Well, there are two views. There is a God and there isn't. The universe is the ultimate reality, or God is the ultimate reality. Ultimate reality is a spirit, a mind, a will that made matter. Or, no, matter is the ultimate reality. It just happened to evolve some spirits or minds or wills called human beings by chance. That's the either or. Which of these two hypotheses is consistent with the data? When we appeal to the good in condemning evil, what are we appealing to? If it's nothing but blind matter, there's no authority there. The difficulty in believing that you are just the accidental product of evolution is fundamentally a moral difficulty. If you're the child of King Kong instead of King God, then when you act like an ape, who can complain? But if you're the king's kid and you're not acting like the king's kid, then people are right to complain about you. And we all complain about each other. We all kvetch, not just Red Sox fans. He concludes the argument, Christianity simply does not make any sense until you have faced this sort of fact. Christianity tells people they must repent, and it promises them forgiveness, but it has nothing to say to people who do not know that they have done anything to repent of and who do not feel that they need any forgiveness. One of the most shocking things Jesus ever said was to the Pharisees, he said, I didn't come into the world for you. I'm irrelevant to you. I'm not your savior. I came into the world for sick people. It's only sick people who knock on the door of the physician, and I'm the physician, and you say you're not sick. Goodbye. That's terrifying. Well, if you're a moral relativist and you believe that morality is purely subjective, then there's no real moral law, and therefore there's no need for repentance. There's nothing that judges you as wrong. But if you don't repent, how can you be forgiven? Forgiveness has to be freely received, God freely offers it, but you have to freely receive it. Suppose I said to you, I've got good news for you. I will give you absolutely free a $250,000 quadruple bypass heart surgery. Would you regard that as good news? Of course not. Why? You don't think you need it. But if you think you need it, and if you think you're going to die without it, boy, that's awfully good news. Well, Christianity comes to us with exactly that offer, a new heart. More than that, not less. Behold, I make all things new, he says. But if you're perfectly satisfied, if you obey the primary wisdom, the first and greatest commandment of our culture's number one prophets, the pop psychologists, namely, accept yourself as you are, well, the consequences of that are terrifying. The reason I don't like pop psychologists is not that it makes me uncomfortable, but that it makes me comfortable. It endangers my salvation. Well, then there's some sort of God. What kind? That's the next step. What are the options? Lewis doesn't get distracted. He looks at the fundamental option. He says at the beginning of book two, in a chapter entitled The Rival Conceptions of God, when I was an atheist, I had to try to persuade myself that most of the human race have always been wrong about the question that mattered to them most. An atheist has to be a snob. An atheist believes that 99% of all human beings who have ever lived have been insane. Maybe some of you have seen this sentimental old movie, Jimmy Stewart was in it, called Harvey. Harvey is a 13-foot-high invisible rabbit. And when Jimmy was a little kid, it was his invisible playmate, but he never grew up. And now he's 42 years old and perfectly normal in every other way, but he believes in Harvey, and Harvey's the most important person in his life, and he always talks to Harvey, and Harvey has to check out every decision, but Harvey doesn't exist. He's nuts. So are you if there's no God. Even nutser. That's a serious problem. But when I became a Christian, I was able to take a more liberal view. Love the way Lewis upsets ordinary categories. But of course, being a Christian does mean thinking that where Christianity differs from other religions, Christianity is right and they are wrong. Well, of course. Why else be a Christian? Oh, but we mustn't say that W word. What? The word wrong. Remember the old Happy Days episode where Fonzie has advised Ralph Mouth to join the Marines, and it's a mistake. Ralph's a geek, and the Marines are not for him, but since Fonzie is so cool, and he's like God to Ralph, Ralph joins the Marine and is toughing it out. And Richie, who's got a lot of sense, convinces Fonzie that he's got to save Ralph's life by admitting that he was wrong and advising him to be a Marine. And Fonzie says, I can't do that. It's not cool. You got to. So he convinces him. Okay, one day he sees Ralph in his Marine uniform. He's looking miserable. As soon as he sees Fonzie, he smiles. Hey, Fonz, how you doing? Huh? How you doing, Ralph? Great, Fonz. Thanks for the advice. This is the meaning of life. This is right for me. Wait a minute, Ralph. You know that day that I told you I think you should be a Marine? Yeah. I got to say something. Ralph, I was, yeah, what, Fonz? I was, I can't say that word. It's not cool. Why do we laugh at that? That's all of us. We don't like to say the R word. I was wrong. Okay, first big division of humanity, somebody's right and somebody's wrong, is the majority who believe in some sort of God and the minority who don't. Now, among the gods, there's a next big division. Basically, the religions of the East and the religions of the West. The God of Jews, Christians, and Muslims is a person who created the universe, and he has a moral will. The God of Hindus, Buddhists, and Taoists is not. People who believe in God can be divided according to the sort of God they believe in. There are two very different ideas on this subject. One is the idea that God is beyond good and evil. This is pantheism. With this difference between pantheism and the Christian idea of God, there goes a second difference. Pantheists usually believe that God, so to speak, animates the universe as you animate your body, so that anything in the universe is a part of God. That's basically Hindu theology. I give my students at Boston College questionnaires, and some of the questions are theological. And one of the questions I sometimes give is, do you believe that everything is a part of God? And about half of them say yes. So I say, you're Hindus. Chocks them. I understand, I expect you understand how this difference between pantheists and Christians hangs together with the other one. If you do not take the distinction between good and evil very seriously, then it is easy to say that anything you find in this world is a part of God. But of course, if you think some things really are bad and God really is good, you cannot talk like that. You must believe that God is separate from the world and that some of the things we see in it are contrary to his will. Confronted with a cancer or a slum, the pantheist can say, ah, but if you could only see it from the divine point of view, you would realize that this is also God. The Christian replies, don't talk damned nonsense. Footnote, one listener complained of the word damned as frivolous swearing. I mean exactly what I say, nonsense that is condemned under God's curse. Christianity is a fighting religion. It doesn't fight each other, but it fights. If you ask yourself the question, how many pages of the New Testament have some verse on it about spiritual warfare? The answer is almost all of them. It's very clear that our enemies are not flesh and blood, but principalities and powers. Christianity thinks that many things have gone wrong with the world that God made, and that God insists very loudly on our putting them right again. Well, then, the next question is about the world or history. What went wrong? What's the Christian philosophy of history? Lewis summarizes this at the end of the next chapter this way. Enemy-occupied territory. That is what this world is. Now, like Jesus, Lewis thinks in images and argues in images. It's much harder to forget an image than an abstract concept. Look at this image. Christianity is the story of how the rightful king has landed in disguise and is calling us all to take part in a great campaign of sabotage. When you go to church, you are really listening in to the secret wireless from our friends. That's why the enemy is so anxious to prevent us from going. I know someone will ask me, do you really mean at this time of day to reintroduce our old friend the devil, hoofs and horns and all? Well, what the time of day has to do with it, I don't know, and I'm not particular about the hoofs and horns. If there's no devil, Jesus is a fool. He took him very seriously. And then you get the most famous chapter in the book, called The Shocking Alternative, the fundamental turning point. And I'd like to take a little time on this. In fact, maybe almost as much time on this as on the rest of the book. I'm going to definitely give myself the hook by 20, 25 more minutes, because question and answer sessions are always more interesting than lectures. What Satan put into the heads of our remote ancestors was the idea that they could be like gods, could set up on their own, as if they had created themselves, be their own masters, invent some sort of happiness for themselves outside of God, apart from God. Out of that hopeless attempt has come all that we call human history: money, poverty, ambition, war, prostitution, classes, empire, slavery, the long, terrible story of men trying to find something other than God which will make him happy. The reason why it can never succeed is this: God made us, invented us as a man invents an engine. A car is made to run on gasoline. It could not run properly on anything else. Now, God designed the human machine to run on himself. He himself is the fuel our spirits were designed to burn, the food our spirits were designed to feed on. There is no other. That is why it is just no good asking God to make us happy in our own way without bothering about religion. God cannot give us a happiness and peace apart from himself, because there is no such thing. That is the key to history. Here's another puzzle that is solved by this Christian hypothesis. Terrific energy is expended, civilizations are built up, excellent institutions are devised, but each time something goes wrong. Some fatal flaw always brings the cruel and selfish people to the top, and it all slides back into misery and ruin. The machine conks out. It seems to start up all right and runs a few yards, then it breaks down. Why? We're trying to run it on the wrong fuel. That's what Satan has done to us. Next step. Here's the whole history of religion in one paragraph. What did God do about this? Well, first he left us conscience, the sense of right and wrong. And all through history, there have been some people trying, some of them very hard, to obey it. None of them ever quite succeeded. Second, he sent the human race what I call good dreams. I mean those queer stories scattered all through the heathen religions about a God who dies and comes to life again, and by his death has somehow given new life to men. Lewis interprets pagan mythology as confused and fallen prophecy. Good dreams. Third, he selected one particular people and spent several centuries hammering into their heads the sort of God he was, that there was only one of him and that he cared immensely about right conduct. These people were the Jews, and the Old Testament gives us an account of the hammering process. Finally, step four, then comes the real shock. Among these Jews, there suddenly turns up a man who goes about talking as if he was God. He claims to forgive sins. He says he has always existed. He says he is coming to judge the whole world at the end of time. Now, let's get this clear. Among pantheists, like Hindus, anyone might say that he is a part of God. There would be nothing very odd about it. But this man, since he was a Jew, could not mean that kind of God. God, in their language, meant the being outside the world who had made it and was infinitely different from anything else. And once you have grasped that, you will see that what this man said was quite simply the most shocking thing that has ever been uttered by human lips. Now, students don't understand that shock anymore because they either don't know or don't care much about history. So there's a very popular hypothesis that Jesus is another enlightened mystic. They don't realize the difference. If a Hindu goes up to his guru and says, I just discovered that I'm God, the guru says, congratulations, you finally found out. Welcome to the ranks of the enlightened. But if a believing Jew or Christian or Muslim says to his clergyman, I just discovered I'm God, the answer is blasphemy. Jesus was not a Hindu. One part of his claim tends to slip past us unnoticed because we have heard it so often that we no longer see what it amounts to. I mean, the claim to forgive sins. Now, there are some theologians who argue that only the fourth gospel gives you what they call high Christology, an explicitly explicit claim to divinity by Jesus, whereas the first three Gospels are much more muted. Wrong. All four Gospels make Jesus claim to forgive sins, any sins. Well, unless the speaker is God, this is so preposterous as to be comic. We can all understand how a man forgives offenses against himself. You step on my toe and I forgive you. You steal my money and I forgive you. But what would we make of a man himself unrobbed and untrodden on who announced that he forgave you for treading on another man's toes or stealing another man's money? Asinine fatuity is the kindest description we should give of his conduct. Yet this is exactly what Jesus did. He told people their sins were forgiven and never waited to consult all the other people whom their sins had undoubtedly injured. He behaved as if he was the party chiefly concerned, the person chiefly offended in all offenses. That, I think, is the secret to why people weep at Mel Gibson's movie, The Passion, and why it's not just a lot of cruelty and gore. If you realize that theological point, it's a mirror. That's what my sins did. This makes sense only if he really was the God whose laws are broken and whose love is wounded in every sin. In the mouth of any speaker who is not God, these words would imply what I can only regard as a silliness and conceit unrivaled by any other character in all of history. And yet, even his enemies, when they read the Gospels, do not get the impression of silliness and conceit. And here's probably the most quoted paragraph Lewis ever wrote. I'm trying here to prevent anyone saying the really foolish thing that people often say about him. I'm ready to accept Jesus as a great moral teacher, but I can't accept his claim to be God. That is the one thing we cannot say. A man who was merely a man and said that sort of thing, the sort of thing Jesus said, couldn't be a great moral teacher. He would either be a lunatic on a level with a man who says he's a poached egg, or else he would be the devil of hell. Well, then you make the transition from theism in general to Christianity. Notice this is all still not dependent on faith. The agnostic who has no faith looks at the Gospels as historical records and doesn't treat Christ as the Christ of faith, but just as another historical figure, follows this argument and says, oh. Last point of the first couple of books. He's focused on Christ and who he is. Now, what difference does that make to me? What's my relationship with him supposed to be? And the relationship that Lewis focuses on repeatedly throughout this book is one that is not the starting point, but the ending point, the fullest one, the one that we're sometimes too afraid to talk about. The Eastern Orthodox call it theosis, which literally means divinization, but it doesn't mean what the Mormons mean when they say we're going to become gods. It means that we share, surely, purely by grace, God's own life. He doesn't want just imitators. And if you look at the images Jesus uses, they're all organic images. They're not imitate me, they're be engrafted into me. And Lewis presents this brilliantly, I think. Let me make it clear that when Christians say the Christ life is in them, they do not mean something merely mental or moral. When they speak of being in Christ or Christ being in them, this is not simply a fancy way of saying they're thinking about Christ or trying to copy him. They mean that Christ is actually operating through them. That the whole mass of Christians are the organism through which Christ acts. That we are his fingers and muscles, the cells of his body. Well, there are enormous consequences to that. And when Jesus says, what you do to the least of these, my brethren, you do to me, he means literally. Which is why when Paul on the Damascus Road is thrown off his horse by the light, and he says, who are you, Lord? And the voice says, I am Jesus whom you are persecuting. There's a double shock there, that Jesus is God and that Jesus is his people, because that's who Paul was persecuting. And perhaps this explains, Lewis goes on, why this new life is spread not only by purely mental acts like belief, but also by bodily acts like baptism and Holy Communion. It is not merely the spreading of an idea. It is something more like evolution, a super biological fact. There's no good trying to be more spiritual than God. If you were standing under the cross and Christ's blood dropped onto you and you received it in faith, you would be saved. But if the good thief's blood dropped onto you, that would not save you. If you're in the crowd and you have the faith of the woman with the issue of blood, and you reach out and touch the hem of somebody else's garment, you are not healed. Touch the hem of his garment, and you're healed. If the devil had succeeded in the temptations and deterred Christ from the cross, we could not be saved. He had to physically die. Sin has an immediately physical consequence, death. So the separation between the spiritual and the physical is utterly unbiblical. They always go together. All right, for the rest of the 10 minutes that I have left before I give myself the hook, I'm just going to give you a couple of typical quotations without much comment to show you Lewis's effective style. Here is a sentence that freed me enormously. I still remember the day I read this at Calvin College. I was worried about all sorts of moral questions and legal questions and worried about legalism and how can a moral law be the absolute? I know it is absolute, but it can't be the absolute. And then Lewis freed me with this one thing. We often think that God wants simply obedience to his rules. What he really wants is people of a particular kind. Of course, that's what a lover wants. He wants saints. He says the same thing a little more explicitly. People often think Christian morality is a kind of bargain in which God says, if you keep my rules, I'll reward you. If you don't, I'll do the other thing. I don't think that's the best way of looking at it. I would much rather say that every time you make any choice, you are turning the central part of you, the part of you that chooses, into something a little different from what it was before. And taking your life as a whole, with all your innumerable choices, all your life long, you are slowly turning this central thing in you either into a heavenly creature or into a hellish creature. Either into a creature that is in harmony with God and with all other creatures and with itself, or one that is in a state of war with God and with its fellow creatures and with itself. That explains the seriousness of moral choices. In a chapter on Christian society or Christian politics, Lewis says less than everybody would like. He doesn't tell you who to vote for. He doesn't tell you how to solve contemporary issues in the light of the gospel. Why not? He says, I think if there were a society in existence that is like the early church in the New Testament, and if you and I visited it, I think we would all come away with a curious impression. Each of us would like some bits of it, and very few of us would like the whole thing. That is exactly what one would expect if Christianity is the total plan for the human machine. You will find this again and again about anything that is really Christian. Everyone is attracted by bits of it and wants to pick out those bits and leave the rest. The chapter on sexual morality is very simple and very memorable. And again, Lewis uses an unforgettable image. Chastity is the most unpopular of Christian virtues today. But there's no getting away from it. The rule is either marriage with complete faithfulness to your partner or else total abstinence. Now, this is so difficult and so contrary to our instincts that obviously either Christianity is wrong or our sexual instinct, as it now is, has gone wrong, one or the other. Being a Christian, I think it is our instinct which has gone wrong. But I have other reasons for thinking so. The biological purpose of sex is children, just as the biological purpose of eating is to repair the body. Now, if we ate whenever we felt inclined and as much as we want, it's quite true that most of us will eat too much, but not terrifically too much. One man may eat enough for two, but not enough for 10. The appetite goes a little beyond its biological purpose, but not enormously. But if a healthy young man indulged his sexual appetite whenever he felt inclined, and if each act produced a baby, then in 10 years he could populate a small village. Thus, there's a book entitled, It Takes a Village to Raise a Child. She knew whereof she spoke. Or take it another way. You can get a large audience together for a striptease act. That is to watch a girl undress on the stage. Suppose now you came to a country where you could fill a theater by simply bringing a covered plate onto the stage and then slowly lifting the cover so as to let everyone see, just before the lights went out, that it contained a mutton chop. Would you not think that in that country something had gone wrong with the appetite for food? You can't argue with images like that. The last part of the book deals with the deepest mystery of Christian theology, the Trinity, the two natures of Christ, and our incorporation into the life of Christ. And here you go way beyond the power of human reason. So there's a preliminary paragraph, which I think is awfully important. It gives you a very rational reason for going beyond reason, a very rational reason for saying, in the Southern Baptist formula, which I love, God said it, I believe it, that settles it. That seems very reasonable to me. Here's why. In God, you come up against something which is in every respect immeasurably superior to yourself. Unless you know God as that, and therefore know yourself as nothing in comparison, you do not know God at all. As long as you're proud, you cannot know God. For a proud man is looking down on things. Of course, as long as you're looking down, you cannot see something above you. He gives another argument for believing divine revelation, and I'm not going to summarize it. I'm going to give you his words. Here it is. If you're a geologist studying rocks, you have to go find the rocks. They won't come to you. And once you go to them, they cannot run away. The initiative lies all on your side. Suppose now you are a zoologist and you want to take photos of wild animals in their native haunts. That's a bit different from studying rocks. The wild animals will not come to you, but they can run away from you. And unless you keep very quiet, they will. There is beginning to be a tiny little trace of initiative on their side. Take it a stage higher. Suppose you want to get to know a human being. If he is determined not to let you, you will not get to know him. You have to win his confidence. In this case, the initiative is equally divided. It takes two to make a friendship. Now, when it comes to knowing God, all the initiative must lie on his side. If he does not show himself, nothing you can do will enable you to find him. And he shows much more of himself to some people than to others, not because he plays favorites, but because it is impossible for him to show himself to a man whose whole mind and character are in the wrong condition. Just as sunlight, though it has no favorites, cannot be reflected in a dusty mirror as in a clear one. You can put this point in another way by saying that while in the other sciences, the instruments that you use are things external to yourself, like microscopes and telescopes, the instrument through which you see God is your whole self. Lewis's favorite argument, the one that moves me the most and many other people too, the thing that even if Lewis is forgotten, he will be, I think, remembered for 1,000 years from now, is the argument from longing or desire. It's put in a lot of places in a lot of books. Here's the shortest and simplest way. It's in the chapter on hope. Most people, if they really learn to look into their own hearts, would know that they want and want acutely something they cannot have in this world. There are all sorts of things in this world that offer to give it to you, but they never keep their promise. The longings which arise in us when we first fall in love, or first visit some foreign country, or first take up some subject that excites us, are longings which no marriage, no travel, no learning can ever fully satisfy. There is something we grasped at in that first moment of longing which fades away in the reality. All right, there's data. How does Christianity explain the data? Creatures are not born with desires unless some satisfaction for those desires exists. A baby feels hunger, there is such a thing as food. A duck wants to swim, there is such a thing as water. Men feel sexual desire, there is such a thing as sex. If I find in myself a desire which nothing in this world can satisfy, then I was made for another world. Familiar stuff, but he puts it together in such a perfect way. The jigsaw puzzle is complete. Here is Lewis's explanation of a passage that one of the greatest teachers of the first century could not understand. His name was Nicodemus. And when Jesus preached that great sermon to him in John 3, Nicodemus says, "How can such things be?"
And Jesus says sarcastically, "You're a teacher of Israel, and you don't understand this?" Notice he doesn't answer Nicodemus' question. He asks a question. Jesus is a rabbi. You know, why does a rabbi always answer a question with another question? Why shouldn't a rabbi answer a question with another question? He distinguishes making and begetting. The creed says that Christ is the Son of God, begotten, not created, begotten by his Father before all worlds. We don't use the word begetting much in modern English, but we still know what it means. To beget is to become the father of. To create is to make. When you beget something of the same kind as yourself. A man begets humans. A beaver begets little beavers. A bird begets eggs which turn into little birds. But when you make something of a different kind from yourself. A bird makes a nest. A beaver makes a dam. A man makes a radio set. Or he may make something that resembles himself more than a radio set, say a statue. But it does not have human life. It cannot breathe or think. Now, what God begets is God, just as what man begets is man. What God creates is not God, just as what man creates is not man. That is why no man is the son of God in the sense that Christ is. They may be like God in some ways, but they're not things of the same kind. They're more like statues or pictures of God. Now, a man who changed from having natural life, Greek word for that is bios, to having supernatural life, Greek word zoe, would have gone through a change as big as a statue which changed from being a carved stone to being a real man. And that is what Christianity is about. This world is a great sculptor shop. We are the statues, and there's a rumor going around the shop that we are going to come to life. Just two more samples. Probably the most obscure and difficult of Christian doctrines is the Trinity. Probably the most popular of Christian doctrines is that God is love. The two, Lewis points out, are almost identical. The words God is love have no meaning unless God contains at least two persons. Love is something one person has for another person. If God were a single person, then before the world was made, he was not love. What people often mean when they say that God is love is really quite different. They really mean love is God. Finally, what is it all about? Jesus never talked vague, idealistic gas. When he said, "You must be perfect," he meant it. He meant we must go in for the full treatment. The sort of compromise we all hanker for is harder, in fact, impossible. It might be hard for an egg to turn into a bird. It would be a lot harder for it to learn to fly while remaining an egg. Now, we are like eggs at present, and you cannot go on indefinitely being just a decent egg. You must be hatched or go bad. And this is the whole of Christianity. There is nothing else. It is so easy to get muddled about that. It is so easy to think the church has a lot of different objects: education, building, missions, holding services. Just as it is easy to think the state has a lot of different objects: military, political, economic, and whatnot. But things are much simpler than that. The state exists for one reason: to promote and protect the ordinary happiness of human beings in this life. A husband and wife chatting over a fire, a couple of friends having a game of darts in a pub, a man reading a book in his own room or digging in his own garden. That's what the state is there for. And unless they are helping to increase and prolong and protect such moments, all the laws, parliaments, armies, courts, police, economics, etc., are a waste of time. In the same way, the church exists for nothing else but to draw men into Christ, to make them little Christs. If they are not doing that, all the cathedrals, clergies, missions, sermons, even the Bible itself are a waste of time. God became man for no other purpose. It is doubtful whether the whole universe was created for any other purpose. So, the universe is a saint-making machine. So you read that and you draw the obvious conclusion. Well, we'd better get on with it. Oh, I went 2 minutes over. I'm sorry. Now comes the opportunity to ask questions about anything under the sun that has any relationship with C.S. Lewis. Yes?
How did you first develop this fascination?
How did I develop my fascination for Lewis? Well, I started reading him. And my first impression was Gee, I don't understand this, but I do understand that it's my fault, not his. I mean, I had read books I didn't understand before, and I wasn't sure whether I was confused or whether the author was confused, but it's very, very clear that this man is not confused. So that was one quality, clarity. Then another one, honesty. And then, perhaps most attractive of all, joy. This is a happy man. He's a puddle glum, he's a pessimist, he would have made a great Red Sox fan, but he's happy.